In the short time that Travis Watson worked as Harris's assistant, Harris had never given in to fatigue. Now, the Liberator needed a nap? Watson took advantage of the unexpected break. His bodyguards in tow, he went to the crematorium and asked to speak to the officer in charge. The clone who came out was an overweight, overage senior chief petty officer with whiskers and a lit cigar.
Oh, what do you want?
The Marines just dropped some bodies off for disposal. I need to have a look at them.
Yeah? And who are you?
Admiral Cutter sent me.
He sent a civilian to inspect the stiffs. What do you plan on doing with them?
Orders.
Well, come on back. We haven't started the honors yet. Just don't do nothing disrespectful.
What state are they in?
They're bagged and tagged.
He led Watson into the crematorium where dozens of body bags lay in a heap. He pointed to the bin filled with bodies and the conveyor belt that would drag the bodies to the incinerator.
Doesn't Admiral Cutter want them flittered?
What does that mean?
Incinerated, flushed into space.
That would not be a good idea. Like I said, he's ordered me to examine them.
Examine them for what?
You have any place you can store them?
We can keep them right here if you want.
Thanks. But if we don't get them refrigerated, they're going to start to decay.
No, the bags do that. The body bags keep them on ice.
Send three of the bodies to sick bay. Once the medics are through with them, we'll send the bodies back for honors.
Yes, sir.
One last thing. Do we have any way of identifying the individuals in those bags?
Well, I told you, they've been bagged and tagged. They died with their armor and their tags on. The bags ID them.
The bags?
Hell yeah. These bags read their IDs and categorize their DNA. You could pull these dead boys out, shuffle them like playing cards, and the bags would still be able to tell you which is which.
3 hours later, while Harris still slept, Watson went to sick bay. The ship's surgeon met him and led him to the back, where the bodies lay in their bags.
I can show you the bodies if you want to look, or we can just talk about the results.
Is there anything I need to see?
No. There are 52 bodies. Two of the men had broken necks and fractured skulls. I found fragments of shattered armor embedded in their backs. They were reported as having been crushed to death. My findings are consistent with the report.
They were crushed?
That is correct.
What about the others?
Almost all of them were shot with shotguns at close range. The damage is extensive. Something strange, though. The uniformity of the damage. All of these men were shot from the same distance and from the same angle. It's almost like somebody lined them up and shot them in the face.
Are you saying they were executed?
Most of these men were already dead when they were shot.
What?
These men were already dead. I found traces of propafenone in their blood. Are you familiar with the term propafenone?
No.
It's a neurotoxin.
You're saying they were poisoned to death, then shot?
They weren't poisoned. The propafenone was already in their bodies. Propafenone poisoning is the medical term for the death reflex. Clones die of propafenone poisoning when they find out they are clones. Propafenone is the death hormone.
Cutter had a row of M27-wielding MPs on the bridge when I came to meet with him.
Back from the dead? How are you feeling?
The day I found out I was a clone, I drank so much crash that I should have died. My head hurt so much the next morning that I almost shot myself. That was the worst morning of my life. This comes in a close second.
What happened on Mars, Harris?
Where do I start? In truth, the mission was mostly a blur. I remembered landing, marching through the spaceport, and stowing away on the train to the Air Force base. I knew everything that happened after that, but I didn't actually remember much of it. I knew my men flew to the Air Force base on transports and that I met them as they came down the ramps. Sometime after that, I had that argument with Cutter. I knew that each event took place, but I remembered none of the details. Nothing stood out in my mind until the fight with the Martian Legion. I remembered every detail of that one-sided battle. Mars is the worst place I've ever been. I owe you an apology. I was way out of line when
That's water under the bridge. You found yourself surrounded by a hostile enemy and you lost men. What happened down there, Harris? I know about the riot and the shootout. You already reported those events. I want details.
What kind of details?
You met with Hughes on Thursday.
Yeah, right. We landed in the spaceport and marched across one of the outer wings. There were people everywhere. We entered the Grand Arcade and the people started yelling and throwing things at us. That's where we lost two men. They were tossing shit at us from the upper floors.
You reported in right after that.
Did I?
What happened with Hughes?
I told you about it. We talked right after I saw him.
What do you think now that you've had time?
I think Hughes would have been better off if we'd left him on Olympus Cree.
He'd be ash.
He'd have been remembered as a hero.
Do you think he feels the same way?
He is as useless. I heard the locals laughing at him. He's worse than useless. He's a joke.
Well, I thought you said you wanted him involved in the relocation efforts.
I do.
But he's a joke.
He's also a skilled administrator. We can appoint him as interim governor over the new Olympians.
Well, maybe so. What happened after you left Hughes' office?
We set up a bivouac in a food court.
Was it empty?
No, we had to flush the locals. They tried to attack a few hours later. They pumped chlorine gas into the air vents. It wasn't much of a problem. I mean, chlorine gas doesn't penetrate combat armor. I had civilian clothing under my armor, so I stripped down and followed a couple of their men to the base.
The Air Force base?
Yes.
And that was when you radioed me?
Yeah. I told you to destroy the tracks, which you did not do.
We destroyed them.
There were three sets of tracks. Your pilots got two of them. The Martian Legion used the third. I guess that was a good thing. They came after us in the Air Force base. Thanks to that track, we didn't need to go hunting in the spaceport. It worked out.
We destroyed the tracks.
Then somebody must have fixed them. The Martian Legion came to the base by train.
I would have spotted their repair crew if you didn't tell me to clear out. Why did you want us out of the area?
Don, I have no idea what came over me. I think I was out of my specking mind.
Okay, so you entered the spaceport and visited Gordon Hughes on Thursday. On Friday, you broke into Mars Air Force Base. What happened next?
I did old-fashioned recon until my men arrived. I counted heads, broke into computers, and hid in the rafters. I didn't get much sleep before the mission. By the time my men arrived at the base, I'd gone 40 hours without sleep. It was a specking miracle the bastards running the base didn't catch me.
You said the Martian Legion was in the spaceport. Who was on the base?
Legionnaires, I suppose. There weren't very many of them.
I see. And you killed them?
They fought to the last man.
What did you find once you had control of the base?
I found out about the religious movement. And I found out how they smuggled 5,000 men to Earth for the Night of the Martyrs. They caught rides on freighters. Some of the boys stowed away in empty containers. Some bribed their way on. Some caught rides as sailors.
5,000 of them? We would have heard something.
We should have. We also found out where the Martian Legion got its shotguns. Nickel Hill forgot some crates when he abandoned the base.
And the new Olympians found them?
All part of their religious revival. Some guy found 5,000 shotguns and decided to build an army of God around them. They thought they were on a divine errand and that God would protect them.
Seems a little optimistic.
Like I said, having one of the rails intact worked out for the best.
We destroyed them.
Either way, they came after us. Hunting them down in the spaceport would have been a problem. We recovered 4,993 shotguns. I think it's safe to assume that the Martian Legion is no more.
Name, Call Matthew C., rank, First Lieutenant, serial number, CM7687491. Age 27, raised in orphanage number 351. Classification, clone, standard make. Status, killed in action. Death by propafenone poisoning.
Call's personnel file had hundreds of bits of information, but those first six fields said it all. He was a clone, he'd risen to lieutenant, and he died from a death reflex. Watson ignored the photos, the medals, the requisite blood type, hair color, skin color, and eye color. Once you classified Call as a clone, the physical description became irrelevant. Watson skipped the findings from the autopsy and read ahead in the file. Like every sailor, soldier, and marine in the enlisted man's military, Call had seen action. He'd fought aliens on St. Augustine. He'd participated in the evacuations of St. Augustine and Gobi. When the enlisted man's empire invaded Earth, Call had taken part in the first wave of the invasion. Like most clone servicemen, Call had a clean record. He'd never been arrested.
Looks like you were a model citizen.
Before joining Tarawa, the recently reinstated 2nd Regiment of the 2nd Division, Call had been stationed at the Mountain Warfare Training Facility, a base located on the west coast of the former United States. His military occupational specialty was infantry. On January 9th, 2519, Lieutenant Call was attacked by 3 civilian men while on leave in Los Angeles. He killed one of the men, the other 2 escaped. The bodies of men fitting their descriptions were later found dead in an apartment. They had committed suicide. Both the local and military police investigated the crime. Both determined that Call's actions were in self-defense.
You were a target on the night of the martyrs. You and Harris. 2 homicidal peas in a psychopathic pod.
Watson, you there?
Speaking.
Speaking, sir. Your old boss is back from the dead. We just had a long chat about Mars.
What did he say?
I'm not going to answer that.
Classified information?
No, not at all. If what he told me is true, there's nothing worth classifying. I have a job for you, Watson. Have you ever met Colonel Curtis Jackson?
The commanding officer?
The commanding officer of 2nd Regiment. I want you to debrief Jackson.
How do I debrief him?
By asking him what happened. Debrief. Interview. Interrogate. Ask. Look, just get me a feed of him telling you what happened on Mars. I want to compare this story to the one Harris told me. I want to see how they match up.
Watson met with Colonel Jackson in a small meeting room inside the Marine barracks of the ship.
Colonel Jackson, I'm Travis Watson. Admiral Cutter sent me to debrief you about Mars.
I thought you worked for General Harris.
The Admiral transferred me to his staff while you were on Mars.
Isn't that rich? I always hear about wives running off while their husbands are on missions. This is the first time I heard about an unfaithful staff member doing it. How did Harris take the news?
He keeps calling me Mr. Navy Man.
Mr. Navy Man. You know, there's a lot of bad blood between the Marines and the Navy.
To hear Harris tell a story? There's bad blood between everyone in the Navy.
I guess that's true. The Army and the Air Force don't have much use for swabbies. As Navy brass go, Cutter's better than most.
Tell me what happened on Mars.
What happened on Mars? That's a tall order, isn't it? A lot of things happened.
Start at the beginning.
We landed, we marched around a bit, and then we went to visit the spec who was supposed to be in charge.
You mean Governor Hughes?
Yeah, Hughes. He was supposed to be in charge, but he wasn't. The bastard was just another grasshopper hopping around the anthill.
What does that mean?
What do you think it means? Grasshoppers are bigger than ants, aren't they? If an ant and a grasshopper scuffle, the grasshopper wins because it's 100 times bigger than the ant. The grasshopper can crush it, bite it in half, or stomp the little bastard into the dirt, no problem. But see, there's no such thing as one solitary ant in nature, am I right?
I've seen scouts.
Me too. And there's always another one a few inches away. Maybe that grasshopper sees the second scout and stamps the little bastard out as well. But that doesn't make him king of the anthill, because there's another scout after that, and another one after that, until you get all the way to the anthill, and there's a whole sea of ants waiting inside that hill. There's a flood of ants just waiting there under the surface, ready to erupt from that hill.
And Hughes is the grasshopper.
He knows he's not in control.
What about the Martian Legion?
History. Gone. We butchered the bastards.
Jackson launched into how the Legion had tried to attack the regiment that first night.
They should have come straight at us then. There were 5,000 of them against a lone regiment. We were fish in a barrel. No place to run, no place to hide. Shot beats bullets at close range. You heard what they did instead?
The chlorine gas?
Yeah, chlorine. Right. We neutralized it while it was still in the vents, then Harris went out after them.
What happened after he left? I heard he lost contact with you.
For a minute or two. They blocked our signal.
How did they do it?
Spec, easiest thing in the world. They call it sludging. You jam the airwaves with a strong signal that drowns everything else out. The interlink isn't an easy signal to block, but I've seen it happen. They sludge the airwaves, and they off their own transmissions too. I guess they didn't have anyone they needed to contact.
They could have warned their partners in the Air Force base.
If they knew Harris was coming.
How did you get your signal back?
We got it back.
That was when Harris ordered you to go to the Air Force base?
Yeah, right.
How did you get there?
We flew in transports.
Right, let me make sure I have the details in the correct order. You landed on Thursday.
Late Thursday.
You marched to Governor Hughes' office.
Yeah, what a waste of time that was.
Then you stopped for the night.
Something like that. We bivouacked in an abandoned food court. Of course, we had to convince the locals to abandon it. Later that night, the new Olympians attacked, and Harris followed them out. He contacted us from the Air Force base, and we followed him out.
And all this took place on Friday?
I suppose so. I lost track of time. The whole mission flew by. We spent some time searching the base, then we had a firefight with the Martian Legion. Next thing I knew, we'd landed on the Churchill, and we'd been gone for a week.
Did you sleep while you were exploring the Air Force base?
Damn well right we slept. We hot bunked. 8 hours of duty, 8 hours R&R. Not that there was much recreation to be had. 8 hours sleep.
How many rest periods did you have?
I don't remember. They all blur together, don't they?
I suppose. Do you think we should move the new Olympians to Earth?
That's Harris's story.
But you don't agree?
We took away their shotguns. That doesn't mean we took away their fight. It's not the same thing.
So you don't believe we should relocate the new Olympians to Earth?
I don't get paid to think. I'm a Marine. I get paid to kill people and break things. My opinion doesn't matter.
Do you have an opinion?
About bringing the new Olympians to Earth?
Right.
I don't trust them.
I see. Did you ever know a Lieutenant Matthew Call?
The name sounds familiar. How do I know him?
He was one of the men that died during the fighting at the Air Force Base.
One of the lucky 50.
Not so lucky. It wasn't just Mars. The poor guy was attacked on the night of the Martyrs.
Another member of the club.
What do you mean?
I didn't know Call, but I guess he's number 6. I got 3 majors in this regiment. All 3 of them were attacked. I contributed a few martyrs myself that night. Then there's Harris. I guess you already knew the bastards attacked him in Seattle.
Watson returned to his quarters and the personnel files. Instead of sitting at the desk, he kicked back on his bed, tipped off his shoes, and rested his head on a pillow. He looked at the personnel files.
Name: Jackson Curtis C. Rank: Colonel, Commander, 2nd Division, 2nd Regiment. Serial number: FM-721-65039. Age: 42. Raised in orphanage number 018. Classification: clone, standard make. Status: active duty.
The man had seen action. Back when the clones were still part of the Unified Authority, Jackson fought against Mogats on Hubble and aliens on New Copenhagen. Of the Night of the Martyrs, his file said,
on January 9, 2519, Colonel Jackson was attacked by 3 civilian men in Los Angeles. He killed 2 of the men, the other escaped. A man fitting Jackson's description of his attacker was found dead by hanging 2 days later. After an investigation, the Los Angeles Coroner Office pronounced the hanging a suicide. Local and military police determined Jackson's actions were in self-defense.
He looked through 2nd Regiment's line of command and found the 3 majors. As Jackson had said, all 3 had been attacked on the night of January 9th. Picking the names of 2nd Regiment Marines at random, Watson worked his way down to the privates. Every man had been attacked on the night of the Martyrs. Watson quickly went to Cutter's office. Admiral Cutter sat at his desk holding a heavily creamed cup of coffee.
You find something good?
Do you know how they selected the men in the 2nd Regiment?
How the hell would I know that? That's Marine business. Ask Harris.
Do you know anything about the regiment?
It's a newly formed regiment.
How new?
Formed last month.
Was Harris the one who formed it? Did he select the men?
Not that regiment. All the men in that regiment asked for the transfer. What is this about?
Every man in the 2nd Regiment was attacked on the night of the Martyrs.
Might be a coincidence.
Admiral, of the 1,600 men who were attacked, 1,500 joined the same regiment. That's one hell of a coincidence.
It's Tarawa. The 2nd Regiment of the 2nd Division is a prestigious unit. It's got history. It's got tradition. Marines respect tradition. What do you think it means?
Something must have happened on the night of the Martyrs.
Yes. Well, something did happen. 1,600 Marines were attacked by a suicidal army of imbeciles. You don't see that every day.
More than that. I think they were brainwashed during the attacks.
Oh, that's ridiculous. It's not possible. Have you seen the profiles of the new Olympians who died that night? They weren't scientists. They were religious fanatics. The ones who survived went home and killed themselves.
Maybe they were the bait. It's like a magician's trick. You get the audience to watch your right hand closely, then you pull the sleight of hand with your left. Harris and the other victims were so busy beating off the meaningless dopes that they didn't notice something bigger.
Can't be. Son of a bitch. Son of a bitch.
The Night of the Martyrs was probably just a down payment. Something quick. Not a complete reprogramming, just a seed to get things rolling. Then they get to Mars and it happens all over again. There's a meaningless attack. 2 men are killed in a riot. A few fanatics try to shower them with chlorine gas. Jackson remembered every detail about the attack, but he went vague when I asked him what happened next.
Just like Harris. Son of a bitch. Son of a bitch.
Cutter tightened security on the ship. There were so many MPs guarding the landing bays, the lifts, and the engine room that I expected to find a skeleton crew on the bridge. Wrong again. He had a full crew on deck and another 50 MPs patrolling the area.
You expecting an invasion?
You can never be too careful.
Yes, you can.
Well, maybe so.
Unless the EME declared a new war while I was on Mars, those MPs must be for me and my men.
Harris, I'm confiscating your weapons.
Just mine?
Your regiment's. We're going to stow them in a secure hold for safekeeping.
Safekeeping from whom? What the spec is going on here?
Let's go to my office.
Okay, we make you nervous. I can see that. What's going on?
You and your men may have been compromised on Mars.
What do you mean by compromised? I'm not a double Y.
No. No, I don't suppose you are.
Do you think they infiltrated my men? So what do you think happened?
What did you mean when you said that anything that can be programmed can be reprogrammed?
You're not still on about that. I told you I was sorry. I don't know what was wrong with me.
Neither do I.
Well, let me get this straight. You're lining your decks with military police because I was rude?
Anything that can be programmed can be reprogrammed. What do you think that means?
Did I actually say that?
Good old Cutter. The son of a bitch was ready for that question. He tapped a few keys on his desk, and there I was, staring out of the screen, looking frenzied and angry.
Do you want me to leave Watson?
Why the spec would I want him around? Give him a message for me, would you? Tell that bastard anything that's programmed can be reprogrammed. You tell him that. You tell him that for me.
Something was happening to me on the screen. I winced. Well, the me in the video feed winced. It was a slight action. I was in pain and trying to hide it.
What was that? What was your message?
Not my message, asshole. Tell him Ray Freeman said that.
Cutter switched off the screen and stared at me.
So what did you mean?
I have no idea. You saw how I looked in the feed. I hadn't slept in days. I don't think I was clinically sane. There's no meaning in those words. What if I said tuna fish eat isotopes? Meaningless. I was a raving lunatic. There is no meaning to what I said. It's the product of fatigue.
What does Ray Freeman have to do with it?
I haven't seen Freeman in over a year.
Watson says you went looking for him on the night of the martyrs.
I didn't find him.
Do you know how to find him?
He finds me when he wants to chat.
You were in Seattle on the night of the martyrs. What made you think he'd be in Seattle?
The last time I heard from him, he was in Seattle.
You went looking for him, but you didn't find him.
I was preoccupied.
General, you are relieved of command.
His words stunned me. At first, I wanted to laugh. I was the one who had promoted him to admiral in the first place. I wanted to threaten him. I wanted to laugh at him. I wanted to take away his command. Instead, I am relieved.
What the hell do you mean you were relieved of command? Cutter's a damned cargo hauler. Who the spec placed him in charge?
I did, Colonel Jackson.
General, we could take the ship.
That's why Cutter has so many MPs guarding the decks.
Ha! We could take care of them rapid, quick, and pronto, couldn't we? Swabbies with pistols. Hell, we might not lose a single Marine.
He wants us to hand over our guns.
Spec that!
I said we would.
You've been relieved of command, sir. That makes it my decision. Shit. I'll deliver the weapons. Who's taking your post?
There's only one general in this man's corps.
Ritz? Run-and-gun Ritz? Outstanding. Once Cutter gets a whiff of Ritz, he'll beg you to come back. Did Cutter say why he wanted you out?
He thinks I was compromised. He thinks I'm working for the New Olympians.
Bullshit!
I'm not going to do myself any favors when we get back. I am going to push to bring the New Olympians to Earth. We need to get those bastards off Mars.
No, we don't.
We owe them that much. They're humans living in inhuman conditions.
We don't owe them anything. We say they're specking hides on Olympus Cree, didn't we? We pulled them off the specking planet before it burned, and then we got ambushed for helping them.
That was a UA attack. The New Olympians didn't have anything to do with it.
We lost ships, we lost men. We lost our specking chain of command all for helping those bastards. The way I see it, we've done too much for them already. And don't get me started on that specking Night of the Martyrs shit. Look, General, maybe I'm bigoted against my own kind, but that's the way it is. I'm natural born, but I still specking hate the bastards. Give me the company of synths any day. The new Olympians might be loyal, but that doesn't explain why they formed a Martian Legion.
We killed the Martian Legion. We destroyed their army.
We took away their weapons, but they may still have an army.
They need to be repatriated. We can't leave them on Mars.
Location: Washington, D.C. Date: April 28th, 2519. The message from the office of Gordon Hughes, governor of Mars Spaceport, came with the governor's virtual security seal.
I have Howard Tasman. Do not send clones.
Cutter read the messages and verified the seal. The name, Howard Tasman, meant nothing to him.
Who is Howard Tasman?
Having started his career as an enlisted man, Cutter did not mind doing a little legwork. He started with a quick search of the Media Link, a mostly entertainment-based network that included magazines, encyclopedias, and reference books. There were no references to Howard Tasman, not even a record of his birth. Apparently, he had not been an actor, writer, politician, or professional athlete. He called Watson.
Have you found Freeman yet?
Not yet.
For God's sake, Watson, the man is 7 feet tall. He eats bullets and shits out dead people. What's taking so long?
I've got every satellite and traffic camera on the planet looking for him. It's like he never steps into the sunlight.
Look, I have another job for you. Maybe you'll be able to get this one done.
What do you want me to do?
Ever heard the name Howard Tasman?
Can't say I've heard the name. Is he important?
Apparently Gordon Hughes thinks he's important.
Hughes?
Hughes sent me a message saying he has Howard Tasman.
Did he say anything else?
Yeah. He said not to send clones.
Are you sending me to Mars?
Not yet. Not until we know something about Tasman first. I want you to go to the UA archives to see what you can dig up.
Not a problem. Anything else?
Yeah. When you leave Bowling Air Force Base, make sure to take your guard. I know about you sneaking out at night.
So Cutter knew he went out at night. Watson could not escape the feeling that the Admiral was using the bodyguards to look over his shoulder. He felt both angry and embarrassed. Watson was a man who could not sleep unless he'd had an orgasm. He had slept well every night since returning from Mars. Since leaving the Churchill, he had slept in nearly every part of town except Bowling Air Force Base. His bodyguards, on the other hand, always looked tired. When he spent the night in a woman's apartment, they spent the night in the car. Watson opened the door of his office. His guards waited on the other side. Two were sitting. The third was asleep on the floor. Their clothes were wrinkled and their faces were puffy and blotchy from lack of sleep.
We gotta go.
Watson went to the security station in Washington, D.C. He found a computer station and made himself at home. His bodyguards remained on their feet, standing a few feet behind him. Tactile sensors in the keyboard of the computer verified Watson's DNA and fingerprints every time he tapped a key. A discrete retinal scanner in the screen confirmed his identity 120 times per minute. Watson did not notice the additional security precautions as he trolled for information about Howard Tasman. A menu appeared.
Tasman H, biographical information. Tasman H, Liberator Project, Linear Committee Briefing, June 24, 2453. Tasman H, Neural Programming Code, March 8, 2454. Tasman H, Need for a Death Reflex, August 17, 2461. Tasman H, Security Profile, updated 2506.
Watson started with the security profile and discovered that if Howard Tasman was still alive, he was an exceptionally old man. He'd been born on a planet called Volga in December 2428. That made him 89 years old. Watson read the name of his home planet and stopped. He'd heard of Volga, but he was not sure where or how. Maybe in school. But it was not one of the big planets, not one of the capitals of the six galactic arms. The file included a birth picture, fingerprints, a footprint, photographs of Tasman's parents, and a DNA sample. Watson skipped all of that. He scrolled through the file, stopping at a picture of Tasman as a young adult just finishing college. He'd studied gene replication and neural enhancement before being hired by the Unified Authority to work in the military cloning program in 2448. Pictures of Tasman showed a man who could blend into any crowd. He was average height, 5 feet 9 inches. He was slightly on the thin side and weighed 162 pounds. He had short brown hair, brown eyes, no tattoos, no scars, no identifiable markings. Watson examined a photograph of Tasman at the age of 21. He had a soft, doughy face. He had narrow shoulders and long, skinny arms. In 2452, after a fleet of ships had been lost in the Galactic Eye region of the Milky Way, the Linear Committee drafted Tasman to work on a top-secret cloning project. Thinking that aliens had arrived in the galaxy, the Linear Committee, the executive arm of Unified Authority Government, commissioned a team of scientists to create an army of superclones that would be known as Liberators. As he began work on the Liberator program, Tasman proposed a method for making the clones more effective in battle. He suggested creating a gland that would release a combination of testosterone and adrenaline into their blood. He called this a combat reflex. He also proposed a rudimentary version of neural programming that would include two sets of active instructions.
1. Inability to commit suicide. These clones will be inserted in a bleak, hostile environment and forced to battle an enemy with superior technology and weapons. There will be a high rate of suicide among them unless we render them incapable of suicide through programming. 2. A diminished sense of conscience. Since we have not had time to properly train these clones for battle, we will need to make them especially aggressive to make up for their lack of combat skills. He's talking about creating sociopaths.
The next picture showed the naval officer in charge of the Liberator project, a skinny beanpole of a man named Captain Bryce Kleiber, who later rose all the way to the rank of 5-star admiral. According to the profile, Tasman proposed using neural programming to build safeguards into future generations of military clones after the Liberator clone disasters. Watson watched a video feed of a young Howard Tasman speaking to the Linear Committee.
Theoretically, there is no limit to the amount of instructions we can program into their brains. But if we input too many sets of active instructions, we run the risk of creating fundamental conflicts in their programming. Even if there are no conflicts in their programming, overprogrammed clones may lack the initiative to act on their own. It does not matter how many sets of dormant instructions you place in a clone's brain, because dormant instructions do not impact behavior. Only active instructions matter.
According to the Tasman theory, clones could hold an infinite amount of dormant instructions that could later be activated should new situations arise. Watson read this and thought about Harris. He'd known about some of the programming. He'd said he could not commit suicide because of his programming. He thought about the Night of the Martyrs. Harris had killed 3 men. He'd butchered them. His diminished sense of conscience had been in fine form on that evening. In 2451, the Liberator clone program was discontinued. According to his psychological profile, Tasman blamed himself for the program's shortcomings. After winning the war in the Galactic Eye, the Liberators were sent out as peacekeepers, but the programming that ensured their success in the Galactic Eye made their term as Galactic Policemen a disaster. When Liberators were sent to stop a riot at Albatross Island, a galactic penal colony, they became addicted to the hormone from the combat reflex and killed all the convicts, including convicts that had turned themselves in. After they finished with the convicts, the Liberators butchered guards and hostages. In 2457, at the age of 29, Tasman returned to his home planet of Volga, where he received a hero's welcome. Volga had been one of those planets that never caught a break. It had no undiscovered minerals, no famous actors, no remarkable athletes. Its economy limped along, and it produced enough food for its inhabitants, but nearly 15% of the population emigrated once the Unified Authority relaxed its ban on planetary migration. Tasman married a local girl in 2458 and moved to the capital city of Neva, where he continued his neural programming research. He and his wife had their first child, a girl, in 2459. They had a boy in 2460. Somewhere in the back of Watson's mind, a memory stirred. He tried to ignore that memory, but he could not ignore the chill running down his spine. It wasn't the name Volga that dislodged the memory. 2460 was a year students memorized in school. The Volgan economy finally failed in 2460. Toxic storms spread around the planet, killing crops and destroying property. Populations never starved during the golden age of the Unified Authority. The government sent food and terraforming specialists who claimed they could fix the environment. By the time they arrived, 80% of the population had submitted emigration forms. The kind of mass migration that the UA Congress had always feared was about to begin. The UA's first response was to bribe the people to stay. Along with food and tractors, the Unified sent the latest line of MediaLink glasses, built sports facilities, replaced automobiles, and sent enormous stores of luxury foods. It was too little and too late. When the UA Congress began rejecting all immigration requests, the people protested, and then they rioted. None of this information was in the files. Watson had learned it in grade school. He learned about the outcome of the riots in grade school as well. The watered-down stories had caused him nightmares when he was a boy. The Unified Authority responded by sending a battalion of liberators, and the Volga Massacre began. 700,000 people died. Watson expected to read that Tasman's wife and children were killed, but he was wrong. He and his family survived the siege. The government relocated them to another planet.
Probably a good idea.
The Unified Authority moved Tasman and his family to Olympus Cree. In 2461, after three more liberator massacres, Tasman appeared before Congress with designs for a new class of clones that would not know they were clones. His design included a gland that secreted propafenone, a neural toxin. The programming and the gland would ensure that no clone would discover his origins and survive. Tasman proposed programming the new clones to believe they were natural-born and raising them in orphanages. Liberators and earlier models started life in adult bodies. Watson watched a video feed in which Tasman told Congress,
"Clones must never realize that they are separate and, therefore, different. If they do, they may rebel. Cloned soldiers who realize that they are not human may decide that they owe no debt for their creation."
Tasman's wife died in 2484. He did not remarry. His children and grandchildren were killed during the first wave of the alien invasion. The date listed was 2514. According to the file, nobody knew Tasman's identity on Olympus Cree. About that, they had been wrong.
Somebody must have known.
Without realizing it, Watson had spent 4 hours in the archives. He sat at the computer thinking about Tasman, realizing how much he disliked the man. Watson looked back at the two clones who had entered the archive as his bodyguards. Tired or not, they stood alert, their hands near their weapons, ready to die in the line of duty. Synthetic or not, they were honorable men. Until that moment, Watson had thought of his bodyguards simply as BG-1 and BG-2. He didn't even know their names. He wondered if he was just as anti-synthetic as Tasman.
You ready to leave?
The bodyguard did not speak. He nodded. The hall that led back to the security station was long and curved, with marble walls and a black granite floor that sparkled in the bright light. There was an odd biting scent in the air, something sharp that reminded Watson of the smell of ammonia. Up ahead, he could see the soldiers manning the security station. One of the guards drew his M27. He started to raise the gun. Because of the bend in the hall, the bodyguard to Watson's right had the clearest view of the station. The clone Watson had always thought of as BG-2 stopped walking and drew his pistol. His hands still holding the M27, the guard fell to the ground as the rest of his team opened fire. BG-2 kept firing. He took a shot in the left shoulder, a shot in the stomach, and a shot in the chest before he slumped to the ground. BG-1 pulled Watson backward as another bullet tore into BG-2's chest. Still staring at the body, Watson stumbled backward as his remaining bodyguard dragged him into the vault. One of the guards ran around the bend in the hall. Aiming his pistol over Watson's shoulder, BG-1 shot him twice. By this time, Watson and his bodyguard had retreated into the research area. The bodyguard pointed at a door across the floor.
Once I hit two of theirs, run for that door.
A soldier sprinted out of the hall. Not seeing where Watson and the bodyguard were hiding, he stopped and waved his gun. The bodyguard took aim. Having seen what happened, the next guards knew where the fatal shot had come from. Two of them dived into the room. BG-1 was hit in his left arm and chest as he pushed Watson out of the line of fire. His eyes wild with pain, the bodyguard shoved his gun into Watson's hands and died. Watson crouched behind a computer, holding the bloody gun in trembling hands. Just then, Watson's driver, BG-3, stepped into view. He held a pistol in one hand and an M27 in the other.
It's me.
The man eased the gun out of Watson's trembling hands.
Wilder sent me a distress signal.
Slowly standing, Watson looked down at the dead bodyguard.
He looked at the dead soldiers, their blood forming a pool of red syrup that stretched into the hallway.
How did you know to come get me?
I told you. Wilder sent me a distress signal.
Who is Wilder?
Tim Wilder. Your bodyguard. He was killed in the hallway.
Watson thought about that. He had considered the man who had died saving his life so unimportant that he had never bothered to learn his name.
Have you met Glenn Heeler?
He's an admiral, right? Isn't he head of naval intelligence?
Watson cursed himself again. He didn't know Curtis Jackson from Martin Riley, from Glenn Heeler, from Joshua Simpson. They were all clones.
Close. He's a captain, not an admiral. He's over interrogations. He keeps offering to go to Mars to collect Tasman from Hughes. You said no clones, right? Heeler's a clone, but he thinks he's a natural born. They all do. It's in their programming. So he keeps volunteering to go.
You can't send him.
I walk a fine line. If Heeler figures out that I turned him down because he's a clone, he's going to have a death reflex.
You have to lie to him.
I can't. He's a trained and experienced interrogator. He can hear it in your voice. He can see it in your eyes. The clone is a walking, talking lie detector.
Send him a memo.
He'll call to follow up.
Don't take the call.
Yeah, that's pretty much what I plan to do. Look, Watson, I need a natural born with a security clearance. That doesn't leave a lot of options.
You're sending me to Mars?
I'd go myself, but I'm too old for this. At least you're young.
You can't go. They'd recognize you.
They might. Listen, Watson, I watched the video feed of your bodyguard's debriefing. I heard how you panicked in the archive. Panic like that on Mars and you will get yourself killed.
I hear most people lose their head their first time in combat. Maybe I'm used to it now.
Location, Mars. Date, April 30th, 2519. Watson stood among the crates in the back of a freighter wearing dirty clothes he hoped would help him blend in with the new Olympians. The cargo hatch of the freighter opened and the work began. Men used forklifts and lifters to transfer crates onto trailers. Nobody paid attention to Watson as he entered the spaceport. Carts with 10-foot stacks of crates sped by him. Bright lights shone down on him. Men with robotic lifters stomped nearby, some carrying crates, some stacking them. Watson strolled unmolested through a warehouse that seemed to stretch forever. He followed an aisle between rows of shelves. Maybe it was an optical illusion, but the aisle seemed to stretch into its own horizon.
Hey, you! Yeah, you!
The man was large and fat and dirty. Whiskers lined his cheeks and jowls.
The spec you think you're going?
I'm on break.
Yeah? Well, we got a shipment to clear.
I've been here since last night. I should have gone home 3 hours ago.
I don't care when you got here, hole. It's another load. You gotta stick it out.
Give me a spec and break.
Yeah? You got a name, kid?
Name's Freeman. Pleased to meet you. Now, are you gonna get out of my way, or are we gonna have a problem?
Hey, you watch your mouth, kid. I'll kick your speck and teeth in.
The old guy was tough, but he was no taller than 5'10", the same size as a clone. He was fat and 50, and Watson was 6'5", dressed like a bum, and fit. He towered over the dock worker, and now that he was silent, the dock worker took note of it.
The guys in charge see you walking out, they'll can your ass. You really want to spend the rest of your life sitting around out there?
Watson said nothing and stepped around the man. He walked out a door and into the halls. The pungent air was so thick that Watson felt smothered. The crowd seemed to close in around him. He closed his eyes, and when he opened them again, he saw that no one had moved. Watson folded his arms across his chest, not because he was cold or tired, but because he wanted to reassure himself that his pistol was still hidden in his jacket. Pinching his fingers over the barrel, he traced the shape of the gun until he reached the butt. The gun was an S-9 stealth pistol, a flechette-firing weapon, good for close-range combat, but useless past 20 yards. Feeling nervous, he looked down the hall. Wason and Cutter had spent hours discussing the mission. His objectives were simple. First, find Gordon Hughes and determine if he was trustworthy. If he could not be trusted, Cutter wanted Watson to kill him.
Kill him, or he will kill you.
Watson hoped he could trust Hughes. He'd never killed anybody. He hoped he never would. Before leaving Washington, Watson memorized the layout of the spaceport. He knew the spot in which he stood and where he had to go. He started walking. He did not blend in. His dirty, tattered clothes were too clean. He was tall and skinny,
but he looked fat compared to the people around him. These people were not starving, but they were not far from it. The warehouse was connected to a major trunk in the spaceport floor plan that would lead to the Grand Arcade. The corridor had low ceilings, maybe 12 feet high. It was packed with people and lined with openings that led into what had once been the loading docks for stores and restaurants. Watson entered the 2-mile-long Grand Arcade. 100 feet above him, condensation dripped from the dirty, steam-stained glass. He tried to find the Martian sky through the atrium roof, but the roof's dusty patina blocked out the light. Looking at the balconies above him, he realized that millions of people had shoehorned their lives into this long, narrow corridor. What must once have been a miracle mile was now a nightmare alley. This was where the trouble had begun for Harris. This was where the two clones died. Doing the math in his head, Watson estimated the number of people needed to run the spaceport might be less than 100,000, maybe only 50,000. That left more than 16.9 million people with nothing to do. The Martian Legion suddenly made sense, as did the religious revival. Men living on blankets with nothing would grasp at fool's gold promises of self-respect and redemption. Fanaticism comes naturally when you have nothing to lose, he thought. When he reached the hall that led from the arcade to the administrative area, Watson took one last look at the stores. People noticed him. He was tall and heavy by Martian standards, and he stood erect. These people slept on blankets and concrete. They had little to eat, and they had little opportunity to exercise. Their bodies had degraded. He entered the hall. 10-foot ceilings, offices instead of stores. This had been a public access area of the spaceport, one used by travelers who had lost their luggage or needed assistance. He passed generic office spaces from which the doors had been removed. People seemed to occupy every inch of available floor space. As he neared the administrative complex, Watson smelled a sharp odor of burned plastic in the air, something he had not smelled in other parts of the spaceport. He turned the last corner and saw the buildings, what was left of them. The area was a cul-de-sac, a rounded dead end with a raised ceiling. In the briefings, the buildings of the administrative complex looked like they were three buildings on a street. They had facades like office buildings with doorways and windows. Two of those buildings had burned to the ground. Their walls had melted, and glass from the shattered windows sparkled among the debris. The buildings had been made of plastic, but now only their twisted and shriveled skeletons remained. Unlike the Grand Arcade and the halls, the cul-de-sac was abandoned. This was the first empty stretch Watson had seen since the warehouse. He had not liked the crowding. Now he liked the emptiness even less. His arms crossed over his chest, he reached a hand into his jacket and gripped the S9 pistol as he looked right, then left, and walked to the third building, the one that had not been burned. As he took a step, he felt pressure on the spot between his eyebrows. It was not hot or hard. As he reached a finger to touch the spot, he saw the scarlet light play on his fingertips. It was a laser, an old-fashioned aiming device. Someone wanted him to know there was a gun trained on his head. Watson stopped. He left the pistol in his jacket and held his hands out so that anyone watching would know they were empty. He waited. No one spoke. The person aiming the laser did not ask for his name or tell him to go away, and the laser continued to shine on him. Keeping his hands up and out, Watson traced the beam to an open window 4 floors up. He saw the pixel-sized glowing red dot and the barrel of the rifle below it. A young woman came out of the building. Moving with graceful self-assurance, she picked her way toward Watson. She stopped 20 feet away from him.
"What are you doing here?"
The girl was pretty, but Watson didn't care. He could still feel the laser on his forehead.
"Governor Hughes sent for me."
"I doubt that."
"It's the truth. He sent the message to Admiral Cutter."
"What message?"
"He said that he had Howard Tasman. He told the Admiral not to send a clone."
"You're not a clone."
"I work for Admiral Cutter."
Her long blonde hair hid the discreet earpiece that she wore. Watson didn't notice it until she pressed a finger against her ear. She stood listening for a moment.
"He says you can come to the building, but he'll kill you if you're lying."
"Who will kill me?"
"Mr. Ray Freeman, that's who. He's the one who sent the message."
The girl, accompanied by 3 armed men, led Watson to a spacious lobby with marble floors and leather furniture. Elevator doors opened at the back wall, and out walked Ray Freeman, tall and massive and dressed in combat armor. He had dark skin and nearly black eyes. The icy indifference in his expression revealed nothing. He had a rifle and an oversized particle beam cannon strapped to his back. Bandoliers packed with ammunition and weapons crisscrossed his chest. To Watson, Freeman personified death. A tiny man with white hair stood beside Freeman. At first, Watson thought the white-haired man might have been a dwarf, because the top of his head was even with the big man's chest. Then he remembered Freeman's height and realized that the white-haired man might have been 5'8 or even 5'9. It was Gordon Hughes, the governor of Mars.
Do you still work for Harris?
No. I think he was reprogrammed.
If you're not with Harris, who are you with?
Admiral Cutter.
Does he know what's happening in the spaceport?
Nobody knows what's happening. You sent us a message about having Howard Tasman. That's the only thing that anybody knows.
Hughes looked up at Freeman in astonishment.
You got a message through?
Where is Harris now?
He's retired. Cutter relieved him of command.
Mm-hmm. Gone to the islands?
I don't know where he went. Admiral Cutter relieved him of command, and that was the last I heard.
He relieved Harris of command? He relieved Harris and he's still alive? That's a good sign. Maybe there's hope.
If that's Harris.
What do you mean, if that's Harris?
I saw a video feed of you assassinating Harris.
You shot Harris?
Freeman did not answer, though the slightest of smiles formed on his lips.
What about Tasman? You said you had him.
He's upstairs, resting. Things never went back to normal after Harris arrived. They've been blocking all communications.
Who? Is it the Martian Legion?
The Martian Legion? God, you're not still talking about the Martian Legion. Harris massacred those misguided bastards.
Location: Hawaii. Date: May 1st, 2519. I wasn't under arrest, or Cutter would have locked me in a brig. I wasn't under house arrest either. I lived in officer housing on Kaneohe Marine Base, and I could come and go as I pleased. It was a beautiful day. Bright sun, turquoise water, powder blue sky. The Hawaiian summer had already dried out the brush growing on the nearby hills, turning it gray. The sun-warmed sand felt good under my bare feet, and the temperature of the water was comfortable as I entered the shallows. 2 feet deep, the ocean was clear as glass. I could see the sand beneath me and could watch for rocks as I started my run. The sun beat down on my head and shoulders, and the water fought against my stride. 50 yards out, surfers caught waves on boards and kayaks. Kids built sandcastles on the beach. The heat, the air, and the exercise worked in concert to clear my thoughts. My thoughts. I kept wrestling the same questions. I remembered everything that happened on Mars, a full week's worth of events, but the details remained hazy. I remembered landing in the spaceport and fighting the Martian Legion, but very little in between. I usually preferred swimming to jogging. I liked diving, my lungs burning as I struggled to wring energy out of every oxygen molecule. I liked pushing myself to see how deep I could go without wearing breathing equipment. I liked the feel of gliding through water. In the past, I preferred swimming to running. But ever since returning from Mars, the thought of swimming made me nervous. I wasn't sure why. I used to ignore my fears, but now I was giving in to them. I stopped running and turned away from the shore. The water was only up to my knees at this point. I waded into thigh-deep water and paused. A swell rolled past. That first cold splash across my crotch was always the most bracing. The water around me was the color of clean glass. It turned darker as I looked farther out. The bluing started a few yards away. Then there was the drop, where the ocean turned royal blue. Before going to Mars, I could not have resisted the urge to dive into those depths. They called to me even now. Little islands rose out of the water not far from me. I wondered if I could reach them, dared myself to try. I took another step out. The sky was bright, and the horizon was a perfect division of pale sky and blue sea. But in my mind, I saw water so cold that the world seemed to freeze around it. I saw strange shapes gliding in water as dark as ink. Looking for fins cutting across the surface of the depths, I took another step out. The water came up to my waist. Cool water on a warm day, it felt refreshing. I started to dive, but that was as far as I got. I stood there another minute, staring out to sea, hating the invisible barrier that stood in my way. And then I turned and walked back to my jeep. I drove to my billet. Having been relieved of command, I should not have had access to weapons, such as grenades and S-9 stealth pistols. but I was on a Marine base. Relieved of command or not, I was among friends. My first day on base, a captain had dropped by to look in on me and told me about the box of weapons he'd hidden in my closet. I pulled out the small box and removed the grenade. It was the size of a golf ball, all black, with a little screen for setting detonation parameters. Not wanting to take any innocent bystanders with me, I selected the lowest possible setting. On high yield, the blast from this grenade would conflagrate half a city block. On low yield, it wouldn't do much more than spray my guts and ceiling into the neighbor's yard. I held the grenade in my left hand, studied it carefully, and pulled the pin. The countdown would not begin until I released the lever that my thumb now pressed. I released it. Now I sat and watched as the seconds ticked down on the screen. When the screen reached 2, I casually covered the lever with my thumb and replaced the pin. I had no doubt in my mind that I could have waited those last 2 seconds. Had I wanted to, I could have detonated that grenade. Fear had entered into my psyche. I felt afraid of swimming in the ocean, even though I knew I was in good shape and would not drown. Fear. I remembered everything that happened on Mars as if it was written on a list, not as if I had experienced it. There was that breakdown in which I had ranted like a madman at Don Cutter, an ally and a friend. And now I could commit suicide. I had simply pulled the pin of the grenade and watched as its timer wound down, something that had been made impossible by my neural programming. I added it all up and came to an obvious conclusion. Somebody had tinkered with my neural programming. Somebody had reprogrammed me. I stashed the grenade back in the box. Then I went to my Jeep and drove away. Instead of heading over the mountains and into Honolulu, I headed east, back toward the beach I had just visited. A minute later, when I checked my rearview mirror, I saw the white sedan. They kept far away, which was fine, though I would have preferred for them to close the gap. I slowed, they slowed, cars came between us. Apparently, the bastards did not worry about keeping me in their sights. I turned left into a small neighborhood of beachfront homes. They followed. I parked beside a public access way that led between 2 houses. Off ahead of me, the ocean sparkled in the sunlight. Walking casually, I traveled from the road to the beach, glanced back to make sure no one was watching, and sprinted along the sand. I ran past 3 houses, then hopped a fence and cut across somebody's yard. I ran along the side of the house and out along the driveway, staying low, keeping an eye on the street. And there it was, the white sedan, parked along the side of the road with 3 men standing beside it. They must have wondered where I had gone, and they'd climbed out of their car for a better look. All 3 stood with their backs to me, facing the accessway I had used to enter the beach. They might or might not have been civilians, but they were not clones. As I said before, I only needed 1 of them to get the information I wanted, so I shot 2 of them in the back with my S9. The 3rd guy watched his buddies fall and still needed a moment to process what happened. He spun to face me. I showed him my gun and he raised his hands. He had some kind of metal box in his left hand. My combat reflex took over. I fired the 1st flechette through his thigh. My 2nd flechette passed through the bastard's left bicep. His hand flopped to the ground, but he managed to hold on to that box. My 3rd shot drilled through his wrist. His fingers fell open and the box rolled out of his hand. I picked up the cylinder. It was about 3 inches tall and 1 inch wide. It weighed next to nothing. It was not a grenade, not a bomb. The more I looked at it, the less it looked like a weapon.
We'd better get you to the hospital.
He tried to stand. Maybe he thought he could run. So I shot him in the other leg. I grabbed him by the shoulders and tossed him into his own car. Then I threw his buddies in on top of him. Slipping into the driver's seat of the sedan, I remembered my Jeep. Once I had my new friend checked into the base hospital, I would send someone to retrieve it. I had something else on my mind. I thought about Seattle and how I had inadvertently killed the man I wanted to question. This time, I would make sure the victim survived. After taking my new friend to the base's infirmary and getting him checked in, I walked to a row of chairs and sat down. A young lieutenant came up to me.
What are you doing?
I want to have a word with that fellow when he comes out of ER.
Why did you shoot them?
They were following me.
How do you know they were following you?
Just a hunch. Along with my S9, I had that strange cylinder in my pocket. I pulled it out and showed it to the lieutenant.
What is that?
I took it off the guy with the holes. I twisted the metal cylinder around and looked at it from every angle. I think it is a weapon of some kind. Whatever it is, the bastard did everything he could to hold on to it. I had to shoot him through the wrist to get it out of his hand. Get it analyzed.
I gave the cylinder to the lieutenant.
Yes, sir.
The man nodded and moved off. I went and picked up the infirmary phone and contacted Admiral Cutter.
I hear you're piling up bodies again.
Maybe today is the third day of the martyrs. Were there other attacks?
Just you. I've seen the video feed. It doesn't look like they actually attacked you.
Bad camera angle.
There are 12 witnesses who claim they saw you shoot 3 unarmed men.
Ridiculous. One of the men was armed with a flask.
So I hear. We'll open it in Langley. In the meantime, what do you intend to do with your victim?
I've got some questions I want to ask him.
Do you plan on arresting him?
That depends on what is in that flask.
You can't detain him, Harris. You either need to arrest the guy or let him go.
Or I can keep him here in the hospital until I'm sure that he's healthy enough to leave.
You are creating a diplomatic nightmare.
Look, Admiral, he's not going anywhere. He took flechettes in both knees. If I need to arrest someone to make this official, I can arrest his 2 pals.
The ones you killed?
The ones who were down when I loaded them into the car. The witnesses don't know that I killed them.
All 12 witnesses reported them as dead.
What do they know? This is a state-of-the-art medical facility. We might have resuscitated them.
One of the witnesses saw you shoot a man in the throat.
I need intel to ID the bastards.
Intel has already ID'd them.
New Olympians?
No.
No?
Unifieds. They worked for the Central Intelligence Agency. I don't suppose you can tell me what 2 former spies and a retired assassin were doing in Hawaii.
Bleeding. Unifieds. Admiral, if the Unifieds are involved, this is going to get ugly.